You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are talking
while married.
You know, Linda, one of the biggest problems that we are seeing in our society right now is the dissonance with law enforcement and what law enforcement officers do. Because of, you know, Marxist groups such as the Black Lives Matter movement, we find that politically we've sort of gone off the deep end. And what we are seeing now is we are seeing suspects being championed.
Yes.
By the progressive left and Black Lives Matter groups like that. And we're seeing the law enforcement community and our brave men and women of law enforcement being vilified. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement goes into the four D's, which is the, disassociation, defunding, dissolving, distancing of law enforcement. And this is the prosecution of law enforcement officers that have such an extremely difficult job and such a high risk job. People are forgetting about that. And of course, then we've got more of the leftist mainstream media championing these groups and additionally vilifying these officers. What makes this whole thing worse is that we're seeing a definite increase nationwide of what I refer to as prosecutorial activism and judicial activism.
And I refer to it as the prosecution and persecution of our law enforcement officers. So today we are joined by a couple of guests, and I want to kind of lay this out a little bit. On November 8th in 2017, Officer Derek Wiley was out on his normal patrol in his police car, and he received a call. And that call would change his life. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is the prosecution of an innocent officer and what it does to that officer and what it does to his family and what it does to society. Because don't forget, Ron, society loses big time when we prosecute and persecute our officers.
Yeah, you know, Linda, and we're so blessed to have Derek and his attorney, Kathy, with us today. This is a unique show for Talking While Married. And I want our friends, our followers, our listeners to understand that Derek's story is one of scores, if not hundreds of stories going on right now, all the way across the United States.
Absolutely. So joining us today is Officer Derek Wiley and his attorney, Kathy Lothorpe, who we've talked to on this subject before. This will be a much more in-depth conversation, and I'm just excited that you are here. Derek, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to start with, can you just tell us a little bit about your background as you were growing up and how you got into law enforcement? What motivated you?
Sure. So I grew up in a small town west of Lubbock, Texas, named Crosbyton, Texas. It was a small 1A school. I think I graduated with about 54 people. Just like any other normal kid, I grew up playing sports, participated in UIL in junior high, was in band, took karate. So I was involved in a whole bunch of activities growing up. I had both of my parents at home, went to church. My uncle was actually a pastor, and I had another uncle that was a deacon. And Crosbyton was one of those places where everybody knew everybody. So it was a real tight community. I graduated high school in 2000, went to college, started off at South Plains College, which is in Levelland, Texas. I graduated with my associate's degree. From there, I went to Texas Tech. I was there for a year. I tried to walk onto the football team, and unfortunately, I wasn't able to earn a scholarship. So I transferred to Canyon, Texas, which is where West Texas A&M is at. And they offered me a scholarship. Played football there for 2 years. Graduated in 2004 with a business administration degree. At that time, I wanted to get into the financial banking industry. So my sister got me a job set up with Wells Fargo as a phone banker. I did that for a little while. And from there, I went to a few other banks as a assistant manager. The last bank I was with was City Financial, where I transferred to the Dallas-Fort Worth area with, and I was working at a branch in DeSoto. Prior to that, I had did my I have a twin brother, as you mentioned, that's in law enforcement. At the time I was in college, he was working in Plainview, Texas. I did a few ride outs with him there, and was really just excited. You know, we went to a call where he was had his lights and sirens on, and I just thought that was really cool and exciting. And so when I moved to Dallas, he had joined DPS, and I decided to pursue a career in law enforcement. When I was with City Financial, I'll never forget this. One day, it was raining all day, pretty hard. And when I got to work that morning, it was a guy laying down on the sidewalk, asleep. And I kind of ignored it. I went inside, started getting a branch ready to open up. Then when the next employee came in, she was like, you know, I think we should check on this guy because I don't know if he's alive. So I went out there and woke him up, and he woke up, and there was a park outside of the building, just to the side of the building. He went out there, was out there all day. He came inside the store a few times and got a cup of water. We had a little water dispenser right there by the door. When I went to lunch, I got him something to eat, and I took it out there to him. And he looked up to me and said, thank you. And he had a black eye, and I could tell that it was a kid. I remember saying to myself, that was God telling me that it was time to do something else. And so, I'm sorry, I'm kind of getting choked up.
No, that's okay. That's touching and fascinating to me. I didn't know that side of you. And it's really good to hear.
You know what's interesting, Linda, about Derek's introduction is that his story, his introduction is not all that much different than a lot of people that get into law enforcement for the right reasons. And, you know, I've always said that there are just a few professions where there is actually a calling, where you get a call from God, you get a call from your soul that says that, you know, this is for you. The priesthood, police work, the military, medicine.
Yes, you're right. You know what I mean? Yes.
And so, you know, your story resonates with me, Derek.
Yeah. So, yeah. Derek, then you decided to get into police work. Mm-hmm. And on the night of November 8th, 2017, how long had you been in police work?
September of that year was my 10-year anniversary, September 7th. So just a little over 10 years I had been there with the department.
Okay, so you're not a rookie. You know what you're doing. You've been around the block a few times. And take us to that evening. What happened, and how did the entire evening start?
Okay, so I'll just start off from earlier that morning. So my stepdaughter was sick. She had a stomach bug, if I'm remember correctly. And At the time, I was working fourth watch, which was 4 p.m. to 2 a.m. So I let her stay home with me during the day. And I remember calling my watch commander and asked him, because I was also scheduled to work overtime that night from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. And so I asked him if I could come in at 8 to give Megan time to get home from work. And then I would go to work and just offset my overtime. And he told me they were already shorthanded and he really needed me there. And the best he could do was 6, which is when the third watch, I believe, or third or second watch left. And so I was like, okay. So I went and dropped Eris off at her grandparents' house. And then, and this was around 5 o'clock. And then I drove to Mesquite, went and got ready for work. Then I stopped by the watch commander office and was talking to him. And you know, we were just talking about family stuff and, you know, having kids. And I got in my patrol car and checked into service. The first call I got sent to was a disturbance that one officer that had already been to. I get there and no one answered the door. And I believe he told me, I guess someone had already left. So I cleared the call, and this was about 6:30, I guess. I cleared the call. Then I went by Burger King and got some chicken nuggets to get me a quick snack. And it was just like a normal day. I was just riding down the street and in my district. And this when I got the call of a male subject in a pickup with the flashers going off. And I got sent to it.
And that was a rainy day, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the first cold day of the year. And by this time in November, you know, it was already getting dark at around 5:30. So it was already nighttime. And it was kind of misting and raining a little bit. But I do remember it being cold because that was actually the first day that I wore my long sleeve shirt.
So Derek, what was essentially the call for service that you received? What were the circumstances of that call? What were you told?
So the dispatcher aired over the radio that it was a pickup truck, a blue pickup truck with the flashers going on and off. And that was it.
And he was in a parking lot, right, of some businesses?
Correct, in a parking lot at a warehouse.
Okay. So you arrived there, mm-hmm. And what did you see?
So, well, let me back up a little bit. Okay. So that was the only information relayed over the radio. And she sent two of us. And the second officer was in two districts over, which was, you know, a pretty good ways from where I was at. And since it didn't sound like an emergency, I disregarded him. And, you know, my supervisor allowed me to disregard him, which is pretty typical. When you go into a call, if it's something that you know, it sounds like you can take care of, or you know, you can advise once you get there on scene. So I disregarded my cover. And when I get there, I'm pulling into the parking lot. And the first thing I noticed was that the pickup was a little bit farther back in the parking lot than what a normal stranded motorist would be. So as I'm pulling into the parking lot, my district partner keyed up on the radio and told the dispatcher to put him on my call. And she responded, he said he would advise. And that was the last radio transmission I heard. So I thought he was on his way up there just because he was my B partner. So as I'm pulling into the parking lot, the witness was bagged up in his pickup truck, which was a white Ford pickup. And he pointed at the vehicle that I was supposed to be making contact with. So I pull up, turn on my spotlight, and gave dispatch the license plate number and something else that I noticed when I pulled up, that it had a paper plate on it. And this was a Chevy pickup. I grab my flashlight, and as I'm walking up to this truck, I can see a lot of movement on the inside through the back window. I walk up to the driver's side door, and the guy looked at me, and he immediately turned his back and started moving around inside the pickup.
Now, Derek, as a active police officer, very proactive police officer, well-trained, what are those things? You know, sometimes people, you know, civilians are not, they obviously, most of the time, they don't have the mindset that law enforcement officers have, but we're very well-trained in making car stops. And one of the reasons that we're well-trained in making car stops, and this is probably unknown by the general public, but you and I know this, is that 25% of all the officers historically every year in the United States are seriously injured or killed during car stops. And so when we get out of a car, our antennas are automatically up. Can you just kind of share some of your mindset that the civilian community doesn't have as you're approaching this vehicle and you're seeing this movement in the car, you're seeing paper plates, you're seeing these different things? What are those things telling you to be aware of?
Okay. So yeah. So these movements in law enforcement, we refer to them as furtive movements, which, you know, is typically when an officer pulls someone over, most people either put their hands where they can see them to kind of put the officer at ease. As I'm walking up and up, you know, I'm thinking, okay, what if this dude take off in this truck, or, you know, what if he opened up the door and start shooting at me? So I'm playing all kinds of scenarios on what I'm going to do and how I'm going to react if this goes south. And that's pretty much typical on any contact when you're approaching a car and you don't know who's inside of it or what they're doing or what they're up to. So yeah, those are all the, you know, scenarios that's running through your head when you getting ready to make contact with someone.
And you know, Linda, and for our friends and listeners, 2017, and I wrote about this in my best-selling book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, 2016 and 2017, especially 2017 when this happened, we had the highest number of police officers killed in the United States since 1972, and before that, in 1933, during the Bonnie and Clyde era, okay? So we are losing police officers left and right, and the state of Texas led at that particular year, at that time that Derek got involved in this incident, Texas led with the most police officers killed that year.
Wow. So you're seeing this person in the car. He's making a lot of movements. It's dark outside. It's drizzling outside. I understand that it was somewhat foggy outside. What happened then?
So as I approached the driver's side door, he turned around and looked directly at me and then turned his back and started moving around. And my first instinct was to bag up and give me some space to react to whatever it was he was about to do. So at this time, I'm giving him loud verbal commands to open the door and show me his hands and get out of the truck. He's ignoring my verbal commands. At this time, I drew my weapon out. Like I said, I didn't know if this guy was gonna open up the door and start shooting at me, or if he was going to put the truck in drive and take off. And also what made the hairs on my neck stand up is he didn't have a shirt on. And, you know, and it's, I don't remember how cold it was, but it was cold. It was cold outside. I believe it was maybe in the 40s, mid lower 40s. And when he started messing around, I had two thoughts in my head. One was this truck is stolen and he's trying to get it to where he can drive off in it, or he's fixing to open up this door and start shooting at me. And come to find out, he, you know, was sitting there getting high and was trying to hide his drugs. So after about, I believe it was about 30 seconds, he finally opened up the door and he was still being hesitant, like he didn't want to get on the ground. When he finally got on the ground, instead of laying flat down, he was on his side, and as he, like he was trying to hide something from me. And so I'm thinking, you know, this, he got a weapon on him and he don't want me to see it. So he's laying on his side. He's looking at me and he's looking back at the truck. And by this time I try to key up on my radio to let dispatch know I had someone at gunpoint and to have my cover step it up. Well, I couldn't get out on the radio. I keyed up twice and I couldn't get a transmission out.
You know, Derek, I want to remind people that, you know, most people in the civilian community, they think that we have all sorts of means of communication. They see us with our portable radios on. They see us with our mics either, you know, in front of us or on our lapel or something like that. And they just assume, because they watch TV and watch movies and everything like that, that we can always talk to dispatch. We can always talk to other officers. But in fact, the truth of the matter is that we can't always do that. And in your particular case, you were getting what we refer to as getting stepped on, because other people were communicating, other officers were commuting at the same time, which was causing your transmissions not to be heard by anybody.
Exactly. We're going to come right back and hear the rest of this story.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli, forensic criminologist, death investigator, and host of A Thread of Evidence on America Out Loud. Are you a fan of CSI shows and documentaries? Are you fascinated with how death investigators like me solve high-profile death cases like you see on the news? If so, then I encourage you to join me as I unpack some of the most high-profile police and civilian-involved death cases in my best-selling book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police. Read all about the forensic evidence you never heard on the evening news. You can get a copy of my best-selling book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, today by ordering it on my forensic site at www.dronmartinelli.com. DrRonMartinelli.com. And remember, without truth, there is no justice.
And this system that we were using, it was a new digital radio system the department had just switched over to. With our old system, we had what we call dead zones, where you just could not get out on the radio no matter what, just because it wouldn't transmit. So I thought that that was the problem I was having at the time. Well, come to find out, it was actually my district partner was telling dispatch to put him back on the 16, the disturbance that I had just left from. I guess he drove by and the party was back. I really don't know the details on that part of it, but he was actually on the radio and I didn't even hear it just because of my tunnel vision was on this suspect that I was dealing with. So at this point, you know, I got him out of the car and I'm telling myself, I can't just leave him here and retreat back to my car. So, you know, I just got to take care of this myself. So he didn't want to get flat on the ground. Ultimately, I ended up having to put my foot on the middle of his back to get him flat down and get him proned out. Once he did that, I thought it was safe to go ahead and try to handcuff him. Like I said, he didn't have a shirt on. It was cold out there. My attentions, you know, I told myself I can just get him handcuffed and I'll be safe. He'll be safe and I can get him up off the ground.
And so people understand that's the reason why you handcuff somebody, so that you can do a good search for officer safety.
Yeah. And the other thing is, Linda, is that, you know, Derek is you know, police officers are trained to either have increasing or decreasing suspicions of what they see. So, you know, they always want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, but certain keys, certain movements, certain behaviors of individuals raises red flags in officers. And at a point like this, the officer has got reasonable suspicion to detain this person for suspicious and possibly criminal activity, and he needs to control them. And this person is not being verbally controlled. He's not being controlled by the officer presence. And so Derek is simply trying to immobilize this person, which is the way they're trained to do, so that he can handcuff him and do exactly like you say, to search him.
All right.
So as I move in position to search him, I lay my flashlight down on the ground. So I'd have, you know, both of my hands. I place my left knee on his back, you know, as we were taught to kind of control the body. Soon as I went for my cuffs, he started fighting. You know, I'm a big guy, and I believe I was probably about 240 pounds, and I mean, I could bench press close to 400 pounds. So, I mean, I'm not a small guy by no means. And this guy was able to flip around on me with all that weight on his back. I'm trying with everything. Once he flipped around, I was using everything I had to hold him down.
I can hear the emotion there, Derek, and understand it well. Never been in that position, even when I was an officer, but I empathize with what you were going through at that moment. Again, dark night by yourself with a suspect that you have no idea what he's up to.
You know, Linda, while Derek is, you know, catching his breath, you know, I think it's important for our audience and our friends and listeners to understand that, you know, the date of this incident was in November of 2017. And here we are now, years later, and it still emotionally traumatizes these officers. And this is a great example of that.
Well, and that's something that people definitely don't understand about officers. Somehow they think that they're sort of invincible and they have no feelings, and nothing could be further from the truth. If you've ever been in the positions to either be in a position like Officer Wiley was, or just to see some of the things that you see on a daily basis on the job, it breaks your heart many, many days that you're at work.
Yeah.
So
Derek, you're involved in basically big wrestling match, hand-to-hand combat with this suspect who might be under the influence of drugs. He doesn't have a shirt on. It's 40 degrees outside. It's drizzling. People are slippery. You're trying to get control over this guy. Talk to us a little bit, if you can, to what you remember about the fight that you were involved in with this man.
So when he flipped around on me, I remember saying to myself, you know, I didn't lose control of his hands, and this going to get bad if he get a hold of my weapon. And, you know, initially I thought that he threw me off of him, and, you know, when I was catching my balance, you know, I was drawing back down on my weapon. But after, you know, we got you on, you know, he was able to see that he reached towards my belt with his hand that was on my gun side. And instinctively, I took a step back and rotated my hips where my gun was rotating away from him. And I swiped his hand away. And that was how he was able to break the hold that I, you know, while I was trying to keep him down on the ground.
No, Derek, let me clarify something there just for our audience, because when you say when you got involved and you're talking to Dr. Ron, Dr. Ron was the police practices expert on your case during your second trial, which we'll talk about upcoming. But so people understand that Dr. Ron was very much involved in your case and your trial.
You know, people, again, you need to understand what this is like. So we have an officer. He weighs just on his own. He weighs 240 pounds. Okay, so Derek is a big guy. Okay, and this suspect was nothing like Derek. His body type was nothing like Derek whatsoever. He was a skinnier guy. He weighed a lot less than Derek did, but he was very flexible. He was very maneuverable. And at the same time, Derek has got, he's got a duty belt on, with, you know, different weapon systems on it. You know, he's got a gun, he's got magazines for the gun, he's got chemical agents, he's got a taser, he's got, you know, all his stuff. And he's got, you know, body armor on, which at least weighs, with a trauma plate, it could weigh up to 7 pounds. So you're talking, he's got boots on. So you're talking about a guy that's 240, but he's got another 20 pounds of gear on him. Okay. Which does not make him flexible. And so now, he's been wrestling around with this guy. The guy was absolutely going for Derek's gun. And this was not necessarily realized until we did a forensic, reconstruction of this using body cam footage and stuff that I'll go into later. So, you know, people might think that, well, you know, this is a big, huge guy and this other guy was not huge, but it's all about, and Derek, you know, is, you know, you're a karate guy, I'm a jujitsu guy, you know, it's all about flexibility. It isn't about how much you weigh or how tall you are or anything like that. It's about flexibility, how fast the other person is, and what their skills are as well.
Exactly. And also in law enforcement, you know, from day one, you always taught the hands are what will kill you. You have to keep control of the hands. That's why you always, if you don't feel safe, you handcuff them. Doesn't necessarily mean they're under arrest. It just means that you're going to detain them until you feel like the situation is safe. So he was also slippery too. So, you know, he broke the hole, and as I'm catching my balance and getting my weapon back out, he was in a bladed position facing me, and I remember seeing his hand pointed at me, which at the time, you know, I thought he had a gun on him, and I told myself he got me, and I'll never forget that. I said he got me, and I remember shooting two times. And he fell to the ground, and he was like, you know, you got me. And I immediately got on the radio and I told dispatch, shots fired. And it was just silence. And it seemed like everything was just moving in slow motion after that. And I don't even think it took the next officer to get there on scene, but to me, it felt like it took forever for them to get there. And, you know, I'm sitting there watching him bleed, and, you know, he's moaning. And then I'm sitting here saying to myself, well, do I go up there and try to help him? Or, you know, what am I going to do if he starts fighting again? So I made the decision to stay, drew down on him because I still didn't know if he had a weapon on him or not. I didn't see anything on the ground, but I just knew I had been in a struggle with this guy. I didn't know what he was trying to do. And the witness, you know, offered to help, and I told him to stay back because I just didn't know. And my cover finally get there. I do a quick sweep of the vehicle, and I asked him if they wanted me to help, and he said, no, go to my car, contact your attorney, and don't say nothing to anybody. And that's what I did.
And your attorney is with us. Kathy, you got a call that evening of November 8th, 2017.
So I arrived home from a typical day at work, and I was sitting down to dinner, and I got a phone call from CLEAT. And CLEAT is an organization that takes up assistance to officers in more than one way, but one of the benefits of this organization is to support police officers if trouble comes their way, especially while in line of duty, as it did with Derek. And they called me to see if I could go to the crime scene. So I stopped my dinner and dropped everything and went out to the location that I was provided.
Okay. And when you got there, what took place?
Well, as Derek said, it was dark. It was 40 degrees, as he suggested it might be. It was wet, cold, misty, kind of, you could still see a little bit of the fog out of your mouth, that type of cold. And when I pulled up down the street, there were just what looked like hundreds of police cars. Of course there wasn't, but it was just red, white, blue everywhere. And I knew I was in the right location. So I pulled up and I identified myself as being the attorney from CLEAT. And they directed me to where Derek was. And Derek was sitting in a vehicle with what they call a shoot buddy. Is that right, Derek?
Correct.
And the shoot buddy was a representative from the department that was to stand by with him, try to keep him calm, answer questions, help him with, you know, notifying family and different things. And it's a wonderful program that they have in a situation of high stress as such as this. Meanwhile, while he was in that car, I could see everyone was working the crime scene. I too am a former police officer, so was able to identify the situation. And at this point in time, Derek was pulled out of the crime scene after the backup arrived and put into this vehicle with his shoot buddy. And when I identified myself, he came out and the two of us went off to the side overlooking the crime scene. And I asked Derek what happened. And, you know, he described it as what he believed to be self-defense. And so I'm listening to it. He's pointing to the crime scene where everything was taking place. And I was looking and observing. And then it wasn't long that some of his seniors, either the sergeant or detective, but someone came up to us and then informed us that this shooting appeared to be shots fired in the subject's back. And I went, that doesn't look good. So with that said, I advised Derek that we will not be doing any talking about this to anyone that evening until we learn more about what's going on.
That might sound kind of unusual to listeners, right? Why didn't you make a statement, you know, to internal affairs investigators, to the homicide team that comes out on that? This person was not killed, but he was seriously wounded. But regardless, what agencies classically do is they do what's referred to as a bifurcated investigation, which means it's divided. One side is done by the Internal Affairs Division. The other side is done by the homicide unit. The DA could send an investigator out there as well. But police officers have civil rights. Just because you put on a badge doesn't mean your civil rights are removed at the same time. In other words, you know, the right against self-incrimination, the right to have an attorney, all these things that everybody has. I mean, we all have constitutional rights, but, you know, Kathy was very wise here as an attorney, because she's noticing, in what Derek is telling her that, he's giving her a representation of what happened. The guy's facing him. He's pointing at him and he's firing two rounds as the man is pointing at him. Derek believed he had a gun and he's responding with deadly force to protect himself. But then forensically, we find that the suspect has two bullet holes, you know, in the back. And so the attorney immediately recognizes that there is a potential problem there that needs to be resolved. And it doesn't at all mean that Derek's story to her about what happened is incorrect whatsoever or could be a lie. It doesn't mean that whatsoever. But I think Kathy was smart enough and prepared enough to know that more things needed to be done with this investigation. And then also the statements are made under the intense stress. So it was good for her at that time to stop that conversation.
And we're going to hear what happened next when we come right back.
My fellow Americans, you've watched for decades as radical Marxists have systematically taken over some of our nation's most cherished institutions. And like us, we're pretty sure you're not happy about any of it. But this is the America we now find ourselves in. AmericaOutloud.com is fighting back with one of the fastest growing conservative media networks in the world, featuring some of the nation's most influential experts and commentators. It is a fight for the soul of humanity. America Out Loud Talk Radio is the voice of liberty and justice for all.
Actually agree with everything you just said. Thank you for saying that. As a defense attorney, everyone, you know, thinks they understand my job, but, you know, we don't know what is out there, what the evidence is, what we have to overcome. And sometimes just being a good listener is a better strategy than being aggressive right from the beginning. So in this scenario, with them saying that to Derek, that it looks like he was shot in the back, right away we all can assume that Derek must be guilty. And on the contrary, he was totally innocent, as the story will evolve and will shed the light on that. It is very important that anyone in a position where accusations are being looked upon yourself, that you should remain silent, exercise your constitutional right, and talk to a lawyer, because a lawyer can get the evidence and evaluate it, where a subject that is, you know, under suspicion may say things that could hurt them and not really understand the content or the meaning been taken out of place. And that can kind of hurt you in the eyes of jurors or the prosecution. So in this case, we were told that as soon as they got all the videos, now let's me talk about the videos. We had the body cam that Derek wore. We had his in-car video that was attached to the front of his vehicle on his dash. And then there was also a surveillance videos that the business owner had. So you got to picture this being a manufacturer commercial place with a very large parking lot, as Derek described it. The lights were out on the parking lot. So as he said, it was very dark, very dreary. And then the mist of the exhaust of the vehicles were also entering in the visual of Derek. And on top of that, Derek's spotlight, when he pulled up, he had his spotlight on. He didn't turn on his normal, you know, reds and red, blue lights. He turned on a spotlight so he can look in the video. So now that light is aimed in Derek's eyes as he got up off the ground to visual where this suspect was, and realized he was in a bladed position, as Derek described. And if you don't understand what bladed position is, he's basically in a position like he's holding a gun sideways to your body, and he's looking at Derek. And why do we know this? Thank God for body cams and other video surveillance type videos that we had, because that's what saved Derek's life. Back in the old days, when I was a police officer, maybe some also you, Linda, I don't know what you had then, but we didn't have all that. And so my word might have not looked really good in the, especially in the political tone that we're in when police officers are being looked at the way they're being looked at. So the video is what saved them. And so we were told that we would be able to come in, and this department is a very good Department, Mesquite Police Department. I'm going to give them a little bit of kudos. No, they were running an honest investigation, and they were prepared to arrest them and do what they had to do. Ultimately, they did. But and it was influenced by politics, and we'll get to that part of the story a little later. But they also believed in the shoot buddy. They also believed in giving any police officer the right to view their videos before talking. And that's what we needed to do. And I told Derek, we'll wait for that, and then we'll reevaluate whether you're going to give a statement. And we did. The following week, a few days later, we were invited in to come view it. And so Derek and I both went to the Mesquite Police Department. We were put in their conference room, and they turned on the videos. They stepped out and gave us the privacy under attorney-client privilege to review it. And after we reviewed it, it was like a sigh of relief, wasn't it, Derek?
Yes. Yeah, I remember you saying, yes, we will give a statement after you saw it.
Yes. Now, of course, that would have been your final decision, but Derek was very willing now to, under my advisement, to do that. Because to us, the video supported Derek's story more so than what they were trying to tell us, that a man was running and was shot in the back. And by now, the news has taken a hold of this, and it grows bigger and bigger and gets out of hand on the story as far as what's going on. And it's funny, the suspect was a Black male. That's very important here. And this is about Black Lives Matter and the Black man being shot by the police department. What they did not understand yet was that the officer was also an African-American. And they didn't take that into consideration. They just assumed it was a white male. So they were ready to make havoc on the news, on how bad this is, police brutality. And all this was on every station around here. And it became high profile, along with a lot of other stories that were going down at the same time. So this is not the only shooting, as Dr. Ron pointed out, in our area that we had to deal with around the same timeline. But we still had the same Black Lives Matter, civil rights activists is, to me, too good of a word for them. Not that there aren't some good lawyers that do that work and needed, but in this case, it was about lies. And so the story grew negatively against Derek, and it got really heated for Derek, and he'll explain some of that later.
And isn't that interesting that the news comes out and falsifies what the information is, because they don't really know, so they make assumptions and they put it out as fact to millions of people.
You know, Linda, not only did they do that, but even once they started knowing the truth, they still did it. So I don't know how much that mattered. They just wanted a good story, and they wanted this political movement, I believe, is what it was all about. And so it didn't matter whether they knew it was true or not. They didn't care.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that I'm seeing nationwide, you know, doing my forensic investigations of officer-involved shootings like Derek's, and also obviously comprehensive investigations of the Black Lives Matter movement, is that that color of the officer does not matter. The only color that Black Lives Matter cares about is blue or khaki, right? The color of a police officer's uniform. So when Derek, as an African American, becomes a police officer, you know, his ethnicity has nothing to do with the argument. It's a police officer killing a Black man.
Dr. Ron, if I may, I sort of agree with what you're saying, because they had to adjust. But even though this was running and they were running it along, the ones where it was a white officer was more in their attention than the once they learned that Derek was a Black male.
No, so, I don't disagree with that, Kathy. You know, and we'll get more into it when yes. we get towards the, you know, how Derek was prosecuted and the political motivations for that.
Right. And so, you know, they still wanted to carry it because it still had value to their movement. And you're right, it now became blue against black or black against blue. And so that's where it continued. And it just got worse and worse. The story was still worse, shooting the poor black male. And you know, it was nationwide, but it was definitely heated in our Dallas-Fort Worth area and local counties around the North Texas area.
So Kathy, how did you begin to prepare for the upcoming trial? And, you know, how did you prepare your client? What were the challenges that you saw as a defense attorney, and how did you handle that?
Well, before we do that, they did arrest Officer Wiley. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
Not only did they arrest him, they made a bail amount that was extremely higher than any murder case. They were trying to get him arrested and brought into Mesquite so they could parade him on the news media. They were all waiting. They called me. He's under, you know, he was indicted really quickly. For that time, he was one of the faster indictments, normally taking up to 90 days, say 60 to 90. In this case, it was weeks. And then they got even faster after his case, where they just, without investigating. Meanwhile, the detective in Mesquite is investigating it, and they didn't care. They were under pressure. They were under threats of indicting him, or the district attorney who was up for election would not get the black support. And that became in social media. I learned of all that. And so this happened fast. They wanted Derek in. I was getting the phone off the hook, and they wanted $300,000 bail. Now, maybe in some states, but not in Texas, $100,000 is pretty high for a murder case, $100, $150,000. And this wasn't a murder case. This was an officer of the court, and the man was okay. And so it's an aggravated assault, which was worth at best $50,000, and they wanted $300,000. So we disappointed them, and Derek had to pull his money out of, I guess, his pensions or whatever source of income. And we did what we called a walkthrough back then. We went to Tarrant County, and they respectfully brought him in there and let him do all the paperwork there. Media had no idea where he was. They're still waiting in Mesquite for him to go in there and go to jail so they can make a mock of him. And they didn't get that pleasure. He bonded out some hours later and never went going inside the jail.
And by the way, that was ridiculous. He was also fired from his job.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to interject because we just missed a huge gap in this deal. So, as Kathy stated, I think it was probably about 5 days later, we went in, watched the video, I gave a statement, and as earlier, you know, you had your criminal investigation and you had the administrative investigation. So I went in and gave a Garrity statement, which is basically something you have to do as long as you're employed. And it cannot be used on the criminal side.
It's a private interview.
Yeah, correct. So I went in, I gave my Garrity statement. And then I believe a couple of days later, I had the meeting with the chief and the two assistant chiefs. So he started reading the, I met with him, you know, he read the complaint and told me that his decision was a indefinite suspension, which is basically a termination. And when he did that, you know, I started crying and, you know, and I got real emotional. And one of the assistant chiefs, and this is something I'll never forget, he started reaching out to me and he said, Derek, he said, listen to me. He said, file an appeal and you'll get your job back. And he repeated that about four or five times. And then by this time, I'm thinking like, you know, what's going on? Why are you telling me to file an appeal, but you firing me? And so the chief was like, keep your mouth shut. Don't get on social media because the grand jury So let me clarify this. So he fired me the same day that the grand jury was meeting. And he told me that he did not want anybody to think that his decision was based off the grand jury, which is why he called me in at, I believe it was 1 o'clock, maybe 12 o'clock that day, and did that. And he told me, because if they find out that you were terminated, it will sway their decision. So, and I'm sitting here thinking, like, what in the world is going on? And so after all that, you know, I got up and he was like, you know, I'll tell anybody you're a good man, you're a good officer. He's like, but you're gonna have to ride it. You're gonna have to ride this out. That's, you know, exact words. And so later that night at about 8:30, before the news came on, the assistant chief, the same one who was telling me to file an appeal, he called and said, hey, man, he's like, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the grand jury didn't come out with a decision. And by law, if they asked about your employment status, we have to release it. So we, you know, we got to tell them that you was terminated. And so later that night, they put on the news that I was terminated. And I knew it was going to get bad after that, because he had already told me that, you know, it was going to sway the grand jury decision. And, you know, I had talked to another supervisor who had told me that he thought that the grand jury was going in my favor. And then when he called and told me that, my heart just sunk. Like, I just knew it was going to get bad.
Let me add one more thing to that. Yeah. Just prior to that Garrity interview, we did cooperate, as Derek said, and we did an interview with the detective. And the way we did it, constructed that, the agreement was, you play the video and Derek will tell you what's going on at that moment. So you can match it up to the video, to what his words were. That way you'll get the story straight. And so when we did that, my vibes of the detective was that he was in our court. He believed that it was lawful use of force. Now, he couldn't come out and say that, but I have a good perception of what, you know, people's reaction. And I believe that Derek did a really good job in telling him, and that it was a lawful use of force. So I believe that that everything was going to work out now that we had a chance to see the video and the statement, and everything went backwards, as Derek just described.
So after that phone call, a week later, and this took place on November 29th. It was on my mom's birthday, and I'll never forget listening to my mom cry on the phone after I told her I was terminated. And a week later, December 6th, I was indicted. And that's, you know, I went and turned myself in. I wasn't arrested by Mesquite, but the DA got an indictment and put a warrant out for me.
You've been listening to part one of The Prosecution of an Innocent Officer. This is a heartbreaking story. People need to understand how these types of political prosecutions affect the lives of the officer who was just doing his job, their family, and society. Please be sure to tune in for part two of Officer Wiley's story, where we get deeply into trial preparation, strategy, evidence, and forensic testimony that combined to turn the DA's prejudice case upside down and resulted in the freedom of an innocent officer.